Sun Agriculture and Veterans Budget Policy Division will come to order. Had a long schedule, members, so we're going to move right along. We will start with organic research at the university, and I believe they're here at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture and Gene N. Friesen Pastureland Cooperative. Capacity of the University of Minnesota to do organic and sustainable ag research. Nancy Alleg, professor and interim department chair of the Department of Agronomy and Plant Genetics at the University of Minnesota. We'll hear from you, and then we'll start into the bills. So welcome to the committee, and state your name for the record.
Thank you. My name is Jean Andreasen, and I thank you all for giving me the opportunity to address you today. I'm here to represent the farmers of Pastureland and Dodge Center. Pastureland is a small cooperative of five family-operated grass-based dairy farms. The cooperative was formed in 1998 with the goal to operate a business that provides a stable milk price for its members. I have been employed by the cooperative as their general manager for the past 2.5 years. Pastureland's farmers practice management-intensive grazing. They focus on building the soil, grass varieties, and pasture ecosystems that nurture the members' dairy herds. They take great pride in their ability to provide their animals with high-quality forage without having to supplement their diet with grain. In the winter, the herds remain outdoors, though they do have access to shelter from the harshest winter weather and are fed primarily stored pasture grasses. Their diet is supplemented with small amounts of vitamins, minerals, and molasses as needed to retain proper body condition for calving. Organic certification is a requirement of all co-op members. We sell our products to restaurants, grocers, and natural foods cooperatives in the Twin Cities, Greater Minnesota, and Wisconsin, and by direct sales both locally and nationally. For many consumers, milk is their entry into the organic food category. Growing concerns about commercial farming practices have fueled the growth of organic dairy sales, reaching nearly $1.4 billion in 2003. The Organic Trade Association expects organic milk sales to grow by an average of 17% per year through 2008, with the National Business Journal projecting 20% annual gross sales within that same period. In recent years, the demand for organic milk has outstripped the available supply. Pastureland has benefited from consumer demand of organic dairy products. On average, Pastureland producers receive twice the price per hundredweight than that of their conventional dairy farmer counterparts. Pastureland has also benefited from the Minnesota Department of Agriculture's Energy and Sustainable Agricultural Grant Program. The purpose of the ESAP program is to work towards the goal of sustainability for Minnesota agriculture by designing and implementing programs that meet the identified needs and support the creativity of Minnesota farmers. Pastureland's 3-year project helped our co-op members identify alternatives to antibiotics, assist in business planning and marketing research, and educate consumers about grass-based dairy while assisting to build the co-op's brand. If we view Minnesota family farms as being an essential component of a thriving Minnesota rural economy, it is to the benefit of all Minnesotans for the university and the Department of Agriculture to focus more of its resources into organic farming practices and specifically perennial pasture-based production systems. Research should be carried out on-farm with participating farms located in every part of the state. Organic dairy farms tend to rely more on forage as feed and less on grain than their conventional confinement counterparts. Research should be specific to building soil quality for healthy perennial plants and maintaining pasture ecosystems. Good permanent pasture management is the most efficient and cost-effective way to harvest the sun's energy and convert it into high-value feed and products with no petroleum-based inputs. More on-farm research is necessary to determine the most durable, high-yielding forages that can withstand our Minnesota weather and the anticipated swings in drought and overly wet conditions caused by global climate change. The deep-rooted systems of well-managed pastures hold soil and water more effectively and efficiently and also prevent soil erosion from wind and excessive rain. If demand for cereal grains for ethanol production increases as expected, the higher cost and reduced availability of carbohydrates to supplement diets for cows will make high-quality forage even more important. Research is also necessary to find more ways to extend Minnesota's grazing season. By determining a plant's ability to take up nutrients from the soil, we can identify what pasture plants might produce an earlier growth start in the spring and what plants continue to be productive late into the fall and early winter. Research will also identify plant species that act to serve as good, reliable stockpilers and the best ways to preserve high-quality, nutritious forage to feed during the winter. Research on bovine genetics and dairy herd management would be focused on developing herds adapted for productivity and hardiness in reduced input conditions appropriate to organic grazing. Studies in ruminant behavior will help illuminate how cows can increase their own productivity in the process of harvesting their own feed. Grazing animals are healthier than confined animals and require less veterinary care. Therefore, holistic health management education should be available to all the university's large veterinary students. The sad truth is our state is losing our dairy farmers. According to the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, the number of dairy farms in 1995 was 11,497. Since then, we have lost over 6,000 dairy farms, and the average age of a Minnesota dairy farmer is 58 years old. Perennial pasture research will help define and readdress how we understand dairy farm productivity in a broader context, not only by rolling herd averages, but by productivity as it translates into healthier and longer-lived animals, improved quality of life for farm families, better soil and water quality, a healthier environment, strong rural economic development, and a thriving rural culture in Minnesota. It is the responsibility of the university and the Department of Agriculture to work together to provide research and resources for farmers who are looking to transition from conventional to organic, and even more importantly, to encourage Minnesotans to look at dairy farming with new interest as an opportunity for a viable career and lifestyle choice. Thank you for your time and attention to this matter today, and I also have copies of my testimony if you're interested or have any questions.
Questions? No, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next one will be Nancy Elke. I hope I pronounced it right or I'm close.
You're very close.
State your name for the record and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Senator Vickman. I'm Nancy Elke. I'm the interim head of the Department of Agronomy and Plant Genetics at the University of Minnesota. And with me is Helene Murray, who's director of the Minnesota Institute for Sustainable Agriculture that houses the Alternative Livestock Program, and Professor Don Wise, who does organic research at the university. The University of Minnesota has a long legacy of assisting the citizens of this state in the production of food and fiber. The University of Minnesota remains committed to providing high-quality research, education, outreach, and extension activities, which have historically had a major impact on the productivity and profitability of many aspects of Minnesota agriculture. As a source of objective research-based information, the University of Minnesota has organic programs that provide producers, processors, and consumers with research-based information ranging from effective, profitable, and environmentally responsible management systems to healthy and safe foods. The university is committed to helping both new and experienced organic farmers be successful. The University of Minnesota can become a leader in organic systems research, encompassing all aspects of production from the field to the table. The organic industry is one of the most rapidly growing components of the food and fiber section of the U.S. economy. Minnesota is a leader in organic production. In 2005, Minnesota was fourth in the nation in organic cropland, with certified organic acreage in Minnesota increasing over 95% over 5 years, and we are fifth in the number of organic farms. Currently, the ongoing research and education program at the Southwest Research and Outreach Center, located in Lamberton, Minnesota, is strong and nationally recognized. The Southwest Research and Outreach Center contains organically certified land and is an excellent foundation in which to build an organic cropping research and education program. However, with the long-term nature of organic systems research, a commitment to long-term sustainable funding is needed to assure the University of Minnesota can continue to be a leader in organic agricultural research, education, and outreach activities. Funding for organic research is needed to provide the extensive management necessary to initiate, conduct, and sustain these complex long-term organic systems research and the extension activities. This investment will provide university faculty with the opportunity for additional resource growth and the leveraging of support for organic research and education beyond what is currently available, and allow the faculty to be more competitive for national and regional granting opportunities in this area of research. Currently, there are over 50 scientists within the College of Food, Agricultural, and Natural Resource Sciences who have expressed interest in some aspect of organic production. These scientists currently conduct both conventional and organic research that cover a broad range of areas, including crop breeding and cropping systems, soil fertility and soil health, pest management and ecological systems research. And the University of Minnesota is uniquely positioned to be a national and world leader in these organic food systems. The development of world-class organic research facilities with the addition of adequate financial support for faculty, graduate students, undergraduate students, staff, and research equipment and supplies would enhance and complement the vision of the University of Minnesota by enhancing research, teaching, and outreach activities of faculty there. University of Minnesota researchers with a commitment to long-term resources would be able to provide a cutting-edge place for conducting organic research over the next couple of decades and provide unique outdoor living laboratories for educating students and producers. One example is through grassroots efforts of committed faculty and students, Cornucopia, a student organic farm, has been operating for the past few years on the St. Paul campus. Cornucopia provides a living laboratory for a broad range of students at the University of Minnesota. The mission of Cornucopia is to steward a student-managed, organic, sustainable farm that provides food, a place for community building, multidisciplinary education, research, and outreach. There's also the potential for the University of Minnesota Landscape Arboretum to partner with the community through the development of a community-supported agricultural farm. This would allow the University of Minnesota to have unique educational opportunities by linking suburban and city dwellers with the production of organic food on the land, as well as allow the University of Minnesota to be a model CSA farm for others to learn and emulate. An expanded organic research program and additional certified organic research land at the University of Minnesota would provide improved information for organic producers about choosing appropriate crop varieties for organic conditions to increase the producer's economic returns and to support the development of new crops and new cultivars specifically developed for the production and processing in organic systems. For example, Minnesota is the number one organic soybean growing state in the U.S., producing 20% of the organic soybean crop. Most of the organic varieties produced in Minnesota were developed by the university's soybean variety development program, and these University of Minnesota developed varieties have allowed producers to open new markets, primarily in the U.S. and Asia. One of the reasons for the intense statewide interest in organic production systems is that Minnesota's small and medium-sized livestock operations are searching for markets that fit their systems in order to remain profitable. Organic production can offer that potential to these producers. In livestock production, feed issues, health management, housing can reduce profit potential. Research to develop practices that increase organic and conventional production stability, control production risks, and increase organic and conventional production, increase the livestock production sector can contribute to farm and rural community stability. Another example is the West Central Research and Outreach Center located in Morris, Minnesota. This center is ideally situated to capitalize on issues facing organic dairy producers. With grazing-based forage feed systems being researched at the West Central Research and Outreach Center, a holistic approach is taken to investigating dairy systems and to provide research-based education and outreach activities. With an on-site herd and pastures, the West Central Research and Outreach Center can study grazing-based livestock systems, blending elements of dairy science, environmental quality, economic analysis, and forage-based research systems. The opportunity would exist to research conventional and organic grazing-based dairy research at this center if long-term sustainable funding was available, allowing the University of Minnesota to provide high-quality information that is sensitive to the needs of Minnesota's farmers and its residents. Organic agriculture is a growing area of specialized crop and livestock production and is being bolstered by consumer demand, industry growth, and an increasing recognition and acceptance by the public. A growing number of producers, processors, and retailers in Minnesota have become committed to organic food systems and have asked the University of Minnesota for information and help in developing a sustainable organic agriculture and food system. Today, I have focused on the activities at the University of Minnesota. In closing, I would like to point out that we do work in partnership with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, the Minnesota Institute for Sustainable Agriculture, which is housed in the department, organic growers, and many other organizations throughout the state. Providing growers the option of reaching these new markets is a team effort at the University of Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions? Okay, then I think we will just move right into the process, and Senator Sharon Erickson-Ropes, if you'd start. And that's Senate File 1027. And maybe at the same time we could have Loretta Joss from Organic Farmer from Gibbon to come up.
Good to meet you.
Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. Great to be here today. And Nancy Elke just said everything I was going to say. So thank you very much. I'll just quickly remind you that the bill in front of you, Senate File 1027, is a great bill for farmers, rural economy, and investment in organics. Rather than doing a whole long speech, I'll just remind you that a few years ago, everyone thought investment in organics was just going to be a little niche market, and it was going to be quickly saturated. And I think we've learned that it's not a niche market. It's here to stay, and, in fact, it's expanding. So I think it's just real important at this time to establish a comprehensive statewide organic research and educational initiative, and that's what my bill does. It will allow the University of Minnesota to become or continue to become a national and international leader in organic agricultural research and build the infrastructure that we need for the research education in agronomy, horticulture, and livestock production. Basically, the bill will fund faculty, graduate students, and staff of the university at a cost of about $450,000 a year. It will fund technical support to positions at Umore Park, St. Paul Campus, and Research and Outreach Centers at Lamberton, Waseca, Morse, Crookston for a cost of about $300,000 a year. There's a graduate research assistantship that will be set up in the areas of organic, livestock, agriculture, and agronomy for $250,000 a year. And then it also funds various pieces of equipment to carry out this research at a cost of about $100,000 a year. I would put it before you that just as farming is about investing in the long term, this Senate file also is about investing in long term. It's a green-green win-win situation for rural economy and for organics in our environment. And I have a testifier here today to talk to you.
Thank
you. Welcome to the committee and state your name for the record.
Loretta Joss, Organic Valley Dairy Farmer, Land Stewardship Project member from Gibbon, Minnesota. And my husband and I operate a fourth-generation dairy farm near Gibbon, along with our son, Kevin. And a bit of our history, we came back to the farm with backgrounds in wildlife and biology and immediately started incorporating those principles into the farming operation and, as such, kind of stumbled into organic farming. Even at the point we certified the land in 1990 and the herd in 94, we still were doing a fair amount of stumbling because there just didn't seem to be a lot of information there available for us. So we are, trial and error, I guess, isn't always the most effective and best way to do things. So we're really grateful for the strides that the university and the Minnesota Department of Ag have made in making research available to us. We participate as often as we can in the Organic Field Days at the Southwest Research and Outreach Center, find the information there to be very pertinent and reliable. Their staff is excellent, not only when you're at the center, but they'll help you any other time or any other place you meet them in the state. So it's been a huge asset to us there, and in terms also of the sustainable demonstration grants and the research that's published in the Green Book. Between that research, we were able to develop our weed control program on our farm and establish our rotational grazing systems, and those are key components for us as organic farmers. So very grateful for this research. You've already heard enough about how the organic industry is growing, but the only point I might add to what you've already heard is that I've learned through my work with Organic Valley doing retail education, and some of the most well-informed, I'll call them organically literate people I've met are in charge of the natural and organic food sections at the stores I work with, and even as such are really struggling with the questions that are coming to them from consumers who want to know where their food is produced and how those production methods are impacting the quality of the food and their environment. So
The whole organic industry is screaming for this research, and I'd really like to see the University of Minnesota be the one to deliver it rather than coming to us from the East Coast or West Coast. So, again, wholeheartedly with Land Stewardship Project, Minnesota Farmers Union is supporting this bill. For the benefit of us farmers, it's something that we really would strongly encourage you to support. So thank you very much for your attention, and I'll try and answer any questions you have. I do have copies of my full testimony here, too, if anyone's interested.
Any questions from the committee? Senator Wergens.
Mr. Chair, I'm directing the question to Senator Erickson-Rope, but in a way, it kind of applies to several of the bills that we're going to hear today. The question that I have is this. I serve on K-12 also, and I think one of the problems that we have with K-12, and I think what we're leading into here, is that we do a lot of funding that's pigeonholed. In other words, it has to go to certain things. So the hands are tied of the particular entity or school. And I kind of see that's what we're doing here, too. We're going to give the University of Minnesota funding, but we're going to say this is what it has to be used for, instead of appropriately funding the University of Minnesota to the extent that we think it should be, and then allowing the Board of Regents and the rest of people at the university deciding where that money is spent and how much of it should go to which department and for what purposes. That doesn't undermine what you're doing with organics, because I'm one of those consumers of a lot of organic products, and I think organics are here to stay. But I have that question whenever we do this in K-12, and now when we start doing it with the University of Minnesota, too, when we start saying, here's some money, but you can only use it for this, and pretty soon we cripple the university from running in the most effective way possible. How do you answer that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Wergen, thank you very much for your question. And Senator Wergen and I sit on the same education committee. So, yes, this is always true, and I think we always struggle a little bit at the state level and federal level, our federal counterparts, with to what extent we specifically request government units below us to comply. But I think we do have we are certainly in a position right here where we can look at a statewide need and determine very clearly with just a small amount of money how you can target an investment and send along some direction to the university that could really fill a growing statewide need. And Professor Wise, would you be interested in answering that question as well?
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Yes, I'm Don Wise. I'm a professor in the Department of Agronomy and Plant Genetics, and I love to be set up like this.
Oh, sorry about that.
It's a long-standing issue in terms of within the University of Minnesota, as we all know. If you look across the state, there's always a tremendous amount of interest in going after competing resources. And within the University of Minnesota, presenting our case and the work that we do in working with our various communities, I think that the reason that this issue is coming before this committee is that many of us within the various programs have done a reasonable job in terms of meeting some of the needs of the organic community. And I think this community is now saying, if we want to be a world leader in maintaining our activities at the University of Minnesota, taking all of the resources, human resources, as well as educating the next generation of students that are going to be part of this industry, there needs to be some capital investment. And speaking for someone that's really low on the totem pole and trying to deliver this set of research and educational opportunities, we find that the resources are very limited. But as you all know, there are many other individuals, programs, the University of Minnesota would say exactly the same thing. But I think in this case, we have the opportunity to present the case that there is this need for enhanced activity at the University of Minnesota in research and education around this agenda. And certainly, there's a strong interest within the faculty to help meet that need.
Senator Wergen.
Mr. Chair, Professor, does the Board of Regents or the President of the University or anyone support pigeonholed funding in this manner?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I guess I can't. I'm not in a position to speak to that.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair, are you done, Senator? Go ahead.
Just one more. Mr. Chair, does this come out of our Ag Committee budget, or will it come out of the higher ed budget?
Senator Wergens, if this makes it out of this committee, it's going to go straight to finance.
Thank you.
That's the recommendation that I would be.
Mr. Chair, I believe it's higher ed finance.
Right.
Okay. Thank you.
I believe we have a gentleman down there that would like to maybe add a little bit to that. Is that okay?
Thank you.
This goes to where?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Todd Iverson, and I represent the University of Minnesota. And to answer Representative Wergen's question, the university, as a general rule, gets very nervous about earmarking of funds. We appreciate the desire by the senator to highlight this. We've had hearings in the House on this issue. I've seen how the Ag Special is being written over there, and organics is being highlighted in their Ag Special. And we have talked with those folks over there, and that's the way they've chosen to handle it. They have not pigeonholed or earmarked funds directly that way. I know it is a highlight in their language, and we respect that, and we will work with the legislature to make that effective. Any time that we see dollars coming to the university for research, we think it's a good thing, and we will certainly work with the legislature and do what you folks ask us to do. But as a whole, the university and the president and the Board of Regents do get nervous about earmarks.
Senator Wergens, no? Senator Coobley?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, you know, to Senator Wergen and Mr. Iverson, I mean, it seems to me that, you know, without some direction from the legislature, I mean, I think legislators go home and they listen to their people and they see a need for something that isn't being done. And it does seem to me that, you know, unless you get some direction from the legislatures, there are some things that the university isn't going to touch until it's kind of a thought after the movement has already gotten underway. And I think, you know, we're trying to provide some research for some folks so that they can make, you know, a judgment onto what might be best for their style of production, kind of ahead of the surge in the movement, if you will. And so, you know, it seems to me that that the state ought not just do their research in one style of production, but that we do research in all styles of production so that we can make adequate information available to producers in terms of what might be best for their operation. And to me, that's the reason that we provide targeted funding, Senator Wergen. Is that, you know, I don't think the university would adopt, you know, some of the areas where research is needed without direction from the legislature.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Coobley, I couldn't agree with you more. The university is more than willing to have the legislature give direction to us and encourage us in several ways. I look forward to, as this bill moves through the legislative process, to working with both the author and to you and the committee members to hopefully reach a situation where we do the research that both the citizens and the legislature want us to be doing, because that's what we are, your land-grant university. We're here to provide that research that's needed, and we will and are willing to work with you to make sure that you're comfortable with the language in the bills, and that we can hopefully be comfortable as well. So we look forward to that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions? Not. Senator Erickson Robes, Senate File 1027.
Thank you. I'd like to move the adoption of this bill and its movement on to higher ed finance.
Senator Dill.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, I'm trying to craft an amendment to this bill, which I don't have complete yet. But clearly the goal here is to provide organic research and education initiative to promote organic production. But some of the research may not show that organic production is good for the environment and economically also superior. So I'm trying to craft an amendment that would say something to the effect that the education and outreach must include information on both the negative and positive economic and environmental effects of organic production when the research supports that conclusion. And maybe I can wait on this amendment, but there's lots of things. Most people think organic production is wonderful for the environment and wonderful for the economy and so forth, but there are some negative aspects to it. For example, all the tillage that organic producers must use to control weeds. Every time you turn the soil, you're releasing carbon dioxide into the air. And it also allows for more soil erosion, both wind and water erosion, because of all the tillage. And so I just want to make sure that the research is done. If there's some negative aspects, that's also communicated to the public, and not just the positive stuff.
Senator Erickson-Robes.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dill, thank you very much. I'd be very happy to continue to work with Senator Dill outside this committee as the bill moves towards higher ed. And maybe we can tune up some of the language to your satisfaction as it goes to higher ed.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Coobley.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Senator Dale, I guess, you know, I'd like to, I don't know if that's done in all kinds of research, but maybe it would be more appropriate to find the statute that amendment would apply to so that it applies to all forms of agricultural research and not just one. Just an observation.
That's fair enough.
I think what we probably should do is have you work on an amendment so it's in writing. Pretty hard for us to take a stand on that without seeing it. And it will go, hopefully it will leave here and go to finance, and they'll refer it to higher ed, and then maybe you can, in the meantime, you can work with Sheridan, Eric and Ropes and craft some kind of an amendment if that's okay. Is that okay with the committee? Okay, Senator, what's your wishes? I need a motion from you to move Senate File 1027 be referred to finance and then in turn will be referred to higher education.
I think I put that motion on the table.
Senator Ropes, I've had a long, hard, confusing day since 10 o'clock this morning. So if I react kind of different, then my mind is in 14 different places today.
Yes, sir.
So with that, members, any further discussion? Not all in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? So adopted. The next one
we'll
walk
into is... Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members.
Senator Sharon, are you here? And I believe... Senator Sharon, I think we need to, if you want your bill in order, we need to have somebody from Senator Erickson-Ropes who moves adoption of the A1 amendment that puts the bill in order that you would like to have it.
Thank you very much, Chairman.
Any discussion? If not, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So adopted. Now your bill should be in order that you want it. So let's hear from you.
Thank you very much, Chairman Vickerman and committee members. I would like to begin by saying that my understanding is that should this bill successfully move through this committee, that it is expected to be heard in the Higher Education Committee this evening. So I think there's room on their agenda should this committee decide to move that forward. I'm presenting Senate File 1026, which is a appropriation of $150,000 in both 2008 and 2009 to be appropriated from the general fund to the Board of Regents at the University of Minnesota for alternative livestock research and outreach efforts. This is money that's expected to be an ongoing baseline appropriation to the University of Minnesota. What I would like to emphasize before turning this over to the presenters is that the funding of the alternative livestock program, research and outsearch programs has been held together for a long period of time by a very uncertain thread of funding from a variety of sources at the University of Minnesota. The purpose of this program is to conduct research and outreach on livestock production and marketing systems that are considered environmentally friendly, profitable, of course, and that are considered helpful to the rural communities of Minnesota. Originally, it focused on swine, but it is now, and in this new money, would expand its focus to domestic livestock, including sheep, goats, dairy, and poultry. An advisory task force is comprised of farmers and university faculty and others that are connected to agriculture that oversee the program. So I think that in order to have some brevity here, I know you have a long meeting, that what I'll do is introduce the presenters. I'd like you to know that I was just at a higher education committee meeting where Senator Dill presented on a bill in which he brought bread and peanut butter and jelly and all sorts of really great food, bologna. Nobody accused him of speaking about bologna, but it was all sorts of various kinds of food. And I got so hungry watching him present, and he didn't offer to share anything. But one of our presenters is from Chipotle, who uses some of this product, and he also didn't bring anything for us to eat. But with that said, I'd like to introduce Amanda Billick from the Minnesota Project, who'd like to testify on this bill.
Chair, members of the committee, my name is Amanda Billick, and I'm a program associate with the Minnesota Project in St. Paul. We are a nonprofit organization that is dedicated to rural economic development that creates a healthy environment. Our work centers on clean, renewable energy and energy efficiency, the promotion of growing, marketing, and serving local foods in Minnesota restaurants and food service, and farm policy and practice that promote profitable farms that protect the environment. We work across Minnesota with staff in New Ulm, Lanesboro, Canton, and St. Paul. The Minnesota Project is also one of the members of the Sustainers Coalition, along with the Land Stewardship Project, the Sustainable Farming Association of Minnesota, Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy, and the Minnesota Food Association. The Sustainers Coalition was formed in 1991 to promote the essential role that MISA plays at the university in providing research and information to farmers seeking alternative and profitable agriculture models. Minnesota Project has been involved with MISA and the Sustainers Coalition since its formation. The Sustainers Coalition continues to discuss and evaluate what research, education, and outreach activities the university should conduct to benefit family farms and rural communities. The Minnesota Project continues to be involved with sustainable agriculture research and promotion at the university. I personally have a strong agriculture background, being raised on a sustainable, now certified organic, diversified crop and livestock farm in Wadena County. I don't get back to the farm nearly as often as I would like to, but my parents still practice and advocate the principles of sustainable agriculture. Livestock is an integral component of a sustainable farming system. The Alternative Livestock Systems Program, administered by MISA, has served as a valuable resource for Minnesota farmers looking for ways to diversify and add profitability to their farm business. Since 1997, MISA has ran the successful alternative swine program, and in 2005 recognized growing demand from producers of other forms of livestock and expanded the program. Currently, the program is working on sustainable production and marketing systems for dairy, poultry, sheep, and meat goats, in addition to continued research for swine. Roundtable discussion groups around the state have identified topics and areas of need that the Alternative Livestock Systems Program can provide. An area of assistance identified is collective marketing and shipping of similar products. Shipping to market, whether in Minnesota or to another city across the Midwest, in small quantities is much more costly for the individual producer. But by coordinating shipping among similar producers, the cost of bringing a product to market can be decreased, therefore increasing overall farm profitability. Collective marketing and shipping is essential to increase the profitability of Minnesota's small livestock producers, and the Alternative Livestock Systems Program can provide that assistance. As consumer demand continues to grow for organically raised poultry, beef, and dairy, collective marketing and shipping will become even more important. New research objectives in the alternative swine program at the University of Minnesota Morris is working to develop management strategies to improve performance and welfare of pigs in alternative housing systems, including loose farrowing, group gestation housing, and finishing in hoop barns. The Alternative Livestock Systems Program provides a valuable service to small-scale and alternative livestock producers in Minnesota. The Minnesota Project recognizes the economic and environmental contribution livestock has in a diversified, healthy farming system. It is essential that this program continue to do its work for future livestock producers through an ongoing funding basis. Thank you for your time and attention.
Thank you, Chairman. I would like to indicate that the $150,000 that's being asked to be appropriated per year, for your information, about $70,000 of that is expected to be spent in salary and fringe benefits for a coordinator. There is an advisory task force that has some costs. They'll have roundtable meetings and field days that will utilize about $15,000 of the dollars. And the remaining $65,000 would be spent on-farm research and outreach center research in the areas of pigs, sheep, goats, poultry, dairy, on-farm processing, those things. The next presenter that I'd like you to have a chance to hear from is Paul Sobosinski, who is with the Land Stewardship Project.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Paul Sobosinski. I'm also, besides working to testify today on behalf of the Land Stewardship Project, which is a farm and rural organization that works to promote sustainable agriculture, I also do farm in southwestern Minnesota and raise pigs. And I would just like to say, in terms of this proposal, this is a piece that I've had the opportunity to work on since about 1998. A number of folks were looking, in terms of the university was looking at doing a research center in terms of conventional swine at Waseca. At the same time, this idea was brought forward doing research at Morris. This particular position was looked at and established from the idea of having the ability to do outreach across the state about alternative systems. If you recall, in 1998, hog prices dropped down to about $8 or $9, less than the depression of the 1930s that my grandfather received. And so a number of folks got together and said, what can we do about getting a market for independent producers? And what can we do in terms of the university having those kinds of resources available? This is not in competition to the conventional, but rather an option for independent folks to have a different way to compete. And one of the ways was to look at differentiating ourselves in the market. So I think I'm going to stop there with my testimony, because I think Mike Fuller could probably more lay out in terms of what that alternative market happens to mean for both producers but also consumers. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Mike Fuller. I'm a local store marketing consultant for Chipotle Mexican Grill. Chipotle was formed back in 1993 by a chef named Steve Ells. Right now we have about 43 restaurants here in Minnesota. What we look at from a naturally raised standpoint is what we have four criteria that meet naturally raised within our company. That means it's all vegetarian fed, no added growth hormones, no antibiotics, and it's humanely raised. We started this as an initiative within our company in 2001. Right now, across the country, we are the largest purveyor of naturally raised meats. Locally here in Minnesota, we have 100% naturally raised pork and poultry, thanks to farmers like Paul, who are part of the Nyman Ranch Cooperative across the country. Across the country, we have 55% of our naturally raised chicken, and 43% of our beef is naturally raised. One of the reasons we're so dedicated to this process is that we're looking for additional sources out there. We go through roughly 40,000 pounds of chicken here alone in Minnesota every week, and we just can't find the sources out there. It's forced us to go down to Atlanta to find appropriate vendors for that type of meat consumption. This is also an initiative, Food with Integrity, that's stretched across our company. We're dedicated from our napkins to our car program. Our gift cards are made out of corn, not petroleum plastic. We're going to have our first green restaurant in Chicago and things of that nature. We're also RBGH-free with our sour cream and soon to be with our cheese. We want to know where our food comes from. One of the critical things is that we're paying a premium for this beef and this meat because we feel so strongly about the quality that it represents. Our goal is to get everything to 100%. That includes all across the country with our beef, our pork and our chicken, as well as our organic beans. Right now we have 25%. Someday we hope to have 100%. We're building up the resources to let them know that there is a market out there for that amount of food to go through the supply chain. We feel that this is a great program, the alternative livestock. If we can increase the livestock, not only will it benefit our company as a whole, that we have more vendors to go to, but it'll also be a local, it'll have a local advantage for us. Thank you very much.
Any questions from the committee? Senator Dale.
Well, Mr. Chairman, maybe someone at the table knows the answer, but Minnesota is the third largest pork producer in the country. And since we've had this alternative livestock research program at the University of Minnesota Morris, what percent of the pork producers in Minnesota, and what percent of the pork produced is being produced by the alternative swine production methods that are researched at the university?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dill, I don't have the exact answer to that question. This much I can say. In 1998, when hogs went down to $8, the idea was formed by a number of folks within Nyman Ranch. One of the first farmers to do it was a farmer from Iowa by the name of Paul Willis, and got involved in getting a few producers together. Since 1998, the same time this program started, the University of Minnesota, the outreach through this outreach program, have set up and held meetings across the state of Minnesota, encouraging producers to look at this. The Land Stewardship Project, with whom I work, as you know, has also co-hosted meetings in this particular area to encourage more producers. So, for example, Nyman Ranch has grown across its about five, six state area, at least as it relates to pork production, from about 28 producers to over 500 producers today. So there has been, a significant increase. Nyman Ranch producers in Minnesota is probably around 67 or 70.
Yeah, probably around 60.
But I'd also, in answering that question, I'd also point out that there are other folks that are procuring meat in this type of matter, too, that are, for example, the Minnesota National Farmers Organization has a program somewhat similar to Nyman Ranch. They have also been part of this process. So it's the BERC program, which is in kind of like southwest, well, it's more than southwestern Minnesota, is another example of area of development. So there's been numerous contacts and numerous meetings held across the state to give information that's been developed through some of the research in terms of make it available to producers about these options.
Senator Dale, follow up?
Well, okay, I don't think these statistics are correct, but somebody had told me that they thought that probably 1% of the producers in Minnesota were using these sustainable organic pork production practices, pasture farrowing and so forth, and it represented about 0.1% of the production. Now, I don't think that's probably correct, but that's why I was asking the question. I was just wondering what your perspective was on it. My sense is that the percent is probably fairly small, but I don't know what it is.
Mm-hmm. Senator Engelbretson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question, Mr. Sobosinski. I don't know. Maybe you mentioned it. What's the difference in price versus the alternative produced and the conventional produced hog? Market price. Is there a difference, big difference?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Engelbretson, I think there's a difference in price, probably $10 to $15 per pig, depending on what kind of premiums you earn in terms of the type of hog you produce. The other conventional system uses a piece centered around lean. This is centered around in terms of, how juicy the pork chop may be,
right.
The taste of the pork chop. That would be kind of true for Nyman and what Chipotle wants to get. The folks at BERC program have their own specifications, so that's another aspect. While we may have some more premiums, we do some things additionally on our farms besides pasture raised. For example, these are raised in deep straw systems. Many producers, existing producers that, for example, may have went out of business when the hog price went down to $8, convert buildings to these kinds of systems so they're making use of facilities otherwise sitting empty. So I think in terms of, you know, in terms of what you're asking, there's a definite advantage. The other piece that I should mention that's probably very significant for independent producers, what killed independent producers is when hogs went down to $8, they had no floor. You know, it just went to the bottom. And under this system, we have a guaranteed floor. Can't remember what it is right now, but I think it's right around that $38, $40 range. So we have a floor, but we also have an open top. So it's a piece that offers a stability to the producer in terms of at least covering the cost of production. So that's an advantage. I haven't dollar sensed it, but if you looked at the pain the producers went through and the dollars that all independent hog producers lost during that period of time, that's a significant advantage.
Thanks.
Further questions? Not. Senator Erickson Ropes moves that Senate File 1026, as amended, be recommended, passed, and be referred to full Finance Committee. Everybody understand the motion?
To higher education.
Then it will go to higher ed, am I right? Yep. That's where it'll end up at. Any further discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? So adopted. Now we're going to move into overview of Minnesota Department of Agriculture Sustainable Organic Program. If they would come up, if two people, Paul Burns, Division Director, and Meg O'Hanlon, also a resource manager. If you two would come up and shed some light on what's going on here. Welcome to the committee and state your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mary Hanks. I'm the supervisor for the Sustainable Agriculture and Integrated Pest Management Programs at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. I'm replacing Paul Burns, or actually he was replacing me while I was out on medical leave for a few weeks. My task here today, and I thank you for this opportunity, is to just let you know a little bit about what the Sustainable Ag Program at the Minnesota Department of Ag does. We're going to be very brief. I know you're under some time constraints. You're wanting to hear the Department of Ag's budget this afternoon as well, so we'll be very, very brief. The Sustainable Ag Program at the Minnesota Department of Ag began in 1989 as part of the Groundwater Protection Act. At that time, the program was begun, the demonstration grant program and the Sustainable Ag Loan Program were all funded initially. The program, as Jean Andreasen so nicely put it in her testimony, the purpose of the program is to investigate and demonstrate sustainable agriculture practices and farming systems in partnership with farmers and others, and provide financial and technical assistance to implement and encourage the adoption of those practices. Sustainable agriculture practices and the Sustainable Agriculture Program includes the organic program at the department. Those practices are resource conserving. That can be soil, water, energy, capital, labor. Protects the environment, enhances profitability, and is good for the farmer, the farm family, and the community. Sustainable agriculture looks like it's different on every farm. So giving a definition of what a sustainable farm looks like is impossible. So what it could look like is it could be livestock on pasture, much as Jean Andreasen talked about. It could be hogs in hoop buildings and deep-bedded systems. It could be cover crops seeded into canning crops or into row crops. It's diversified crop rotations and diversified farms, farms with energy crops, fruits, vegetables, livestock, legumes, small grains. It's value-added. It's on-farm processing. It's cheese-making. It's energy production, ethanol production. It's direct marketing through farmers' markets, through marketing co-ops, much like pasture land, selling through to educational institutions, food co-ops, directly at to restaurants. And it also includes input reduction, less energy, less purchased inputs, more reliance on animal manures, and just different ways of energy efficiency, reducing the use of petrochemicals. What the program at the department does, we have a number of different areas. The one that is being addressed today is on-farm research and demonstration grants. This program, like I said, began in 1989. This provides money primarily to farmers to address issues, questions on their own farms in a setting, usually with a technical advisor, extension, soil and water conservation districts, whatever they need, to address questions on their farms. We also have the low-interest loan program. Once farmers decide what types of systems they want to try, this program, the interest rate right now is at 3%. Can purchase the equipment, modify their buildings to produce hogs in a different way, whatever they need to implement those programs. We also provide grazing technical assistance. That program is a 50-50 split with the Minnesota NRCS. We provide 50% of the funding, and NRCS provides the other half. My colleague, Meg Moynihan, will talk just briefly about the organic program, which is part of this. We also published the Green Book, and I do have copies here for everybody. I don't know if everybody has already received one or not. We published with the University of Minnesota and others such things as Dairy Your Way, which is a book that goes through not just organic, not just it goes from conventional through organic production, different types of dairy parlors, and is available free to farmers who are interested. We also do Poultry Your Way, and there's a Hogs Your Way. Like I said, we work in partnership and with the advice and input of farmers. We work with the Minnesota Institute for Sustainable Agriculture, with Farmers Union, with Farm Bureau, with anyone, everyone, in order to address the needs of farmers. I'm going to turn this over to my colleague to talk about the organic program more specifically.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, thank you for the invitation to be here today. For the record, my name is Meg Moynihan. I serve as the Minnesota Department of Agriculture's Organic and Diversification Specialist and have for the last 5 years. My purpose is to give you a brief overview of the status of organic agriculture in Minnesota and some of the ways that the department is working to address the needs of organic farmers and, in fact, the entire organic marketing structure. We recognize organic as a value-added diversification strategy that has appealed to many farmers and that farmers choose to adopt for various reasons. Across the state, it looks very different. Farms across Minnesota look different, and organic is no exception. We have ranging from 10-acre organic vegetable farms that may serve the Twin Cities up to 3,000-acre operations in the Red River Valley that focus on cash grain and exports. The market is very strong. Several of the other testifiers have mentioned this. We know from Economic Research Service of USDA and industry estimates that it's been growing about 20% per year for the last decade. And there are some categories like dairy and meat, fish, and poultry, which are growing even faster than that. So this is a market opportunity that our farmers have an opportunity to participate in. And right now it's about $14 billion a year. It is governed now by federal law and standards, federal standards that we in Minnesota have adopted by reference. And the federal law requires certification by third parties that are accredited by the USDA to ensure that organic farms and organic processing facilities are in compliance with federal regulation. Some of those, Senator Dill raised some questions earlier about environmental considerations, and some of those are the specifics of practices that protect and improve soil and water quality and prevent contamination. So that is a focus. We are doing well in Minnesota. We were early adopters of organic. The last estimates by the Economic Research Service say we have 433 certified organic farms in the state. My own count is higher than that, and I put us at a few more than 500 farms. So we're doing well. We ranked number 5 in organic farms in the nation. We ranked 4th in organic crop acres and 6th in total acres the last time the USDA released those organic estimates. And I'm proud to tell you that we are number 1 in organic corn, organic soybeans, and we're top 5 for a number of other grain categories, number 7 in dairy cows, number 6 in broilers. The department supports organic growers and the affiliated industries in a number of ways, and I just want to talk briefly about four. One of these is certification cost share. The state provides some regulatory relief to certified organic farmers who must who bear the burden of proof that they, in fact, are certified organic. According to the information that we collect, that costs about $900 a year. That's a low estimate. And currently, the state has $35,000 to apportion among organic farmers for two-thirds of their certification costs, capped at $200. That is a program that's been very popular. Between 2003 and 2005, we also had some federal money that was even more generous than we were able to provide in the state, and that made us even more popular, but we do have that base funding. The second is an educational function. We host and are the only state in the nation to do this, the Minnesota Organic Conference. Each year, it happens in the winter. This year, it attracted 425 people, new and returning attendees to St. Cloud, and focuses on production practices, marketing opportunities, networking among producers, a sold-out trade show. It's a very popular event and is growing in attendance every year, so we're proud to be able to do that. That is underwritten by private sponsors and also by some USDA money. We have, as being distributed to you, also supported with funds from Risk Management Agency of USDA, a directory of Minnesota organic farms, and you will find that each of you has constituents who have certified organic operations. They're listed by what they grow. They're also listed by their county here. This is a voluntary directory and lists fewer than half of the certified growers that we have. So while I said we have more than 500, there are about 200 in the directory, and I encourage you to get to know them if you would like. And then the final project I wanted to talk about has special meaning to this committee because it was born here. The idea of it was born here several years ago when Senator Dill asked me a question I couldn't answer about organic production and how much time it takes an organic farmer to produce an acre of organic soybeans versus a conventional farmer. And I said, well, what an innovative way of looking at this, Senator Dill. I don't know. And I went off and came up with a project that would help us do that. And it is an organic farm business management program. It attracted some funding from the USDA, again, the Risk Management Agency. We are doing this in partnership with the Center for Farm Financial Management at the University of Minnesota. And they are revamping their FinPAC business software program and their FinBin reporting software to make it more useful to organic farmers. And we are offering scholarships to organic producers to find out if this tool, which is so helpful to conventional producers in this state, will also be helpful to organic producers. And I'm very happy to tell you that we have more than 60 producers enrolled in this program compared to 10 last year. So I'm hoping that by the end of March we have some excellent data, real-world production data that the farmers can use on their own operations, but that we can also share with researchers and decision-makers such as yourselves. Dr. Elke mentioned the high degree of collaboration in Minnesota. I just want to reiterate that. There is a very high degree of collaboration in Minnesota among state agencies, federal agencies, the University of Minnesota, and Extension that allows us to do all of this good work. And there is far more detail in our new legislative report, The Status of Organic Agriculture in Minnesota. Our legislative policy director, I believe, delivered copies to you. I included, just as an extra bonus in your directory, the executive summary from that report, and certainly am always available to answer questions that you or your constituents might have. Senator Vickerman, thank you very much for your time, and certainly I'd be happy to answer questions.
I knew the minute you said Senator Dill had a question. He was going to raise his hand, and I see he raised his hand. So, Senator Dill.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, I don't have a question. I just want to thank Ms. Moynihan for going ahead and getting the program off the ground so that we do have some decent financial records from organic producers so we can actually see what's going on. And the fact that you've got 60 farmers in the system already, that's very good. And you said the results are, well, are you talking about the results being available this year for last year or for this year and next year?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dill, the results for 2006, which is the first year we enrolled these people, will be available in March, this month, later this month.
Okay.
The Farm Business Management instructors are currently working on those analyses with their students, and then that all of the identifying information gets stripped off, and that information goes into a very large multi-state database called FinBin that's available on the World Wide Web. So some comparisons and reports can be done so that the farmers can benchmark with each other as well as looking at their own operations.
And then in the production year 2006, was that when you had the 10 farmers or the 60 farmers?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dill, 2006 was the 60 farmers.
Okay.
It was it was about 10 before we kicked this program off the ground.
Okay, well, that's very good. It'll be very interesting to see what the results are.
Thank you.
Senator Coring.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Moynihan, in this book, the directory here, does this have all the listings? Because my cousin, Steve Coring, is a organic dairy farmer, and I don't see his name in here. So does it have all the listings? Or?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Coring, no, it does not. The short answer is no. That is a voluntary directory,
oh.
And we invited producers to list themselves. We certainly didn't want to list any information without their permission.
Okay.
And after I published the directory, I had a mess of calls from people saying, why am I not in this directory?
Okay.
And wanting to be in the next one. And also wanted to mention that the dairy farmer Coring has been a valuable speaker at our organic conference.
Well, I just wanted to let everybody know how the Coring name is synonymous throughout the country here. We're on the cutting edge. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any more questions of the two testifiers? Thank you very much for your testimony. I'm going to juggle the schedule a little bit to accommodate Senator Day, who was here, so he does, because we got a lot of more work to do. Senator Day, why don't you... And I believe you have Jennifer O'Rourke, I think, is there. She would come up.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much, and members, and we'll be relatively quick on the bill 1202. We do have some changes. Number one was to... To delete.
Senator Day,
maybe you could explain it.
Senator Day, I've been told that there's an amendment Senator Dill might have put on your bill so that in order you'd like to have it. So Senator Dill, could you do that?
Well, yeah, Mr. Chairman, members, Senator Day, correct me if this is not what you want, but I was told that this is an amendment that you wanted somebody on the committee to offer to get your bill in the form that you would like to have it in. And we're dealing with Senate File number 170. I know you mentioned a different number there, but I believe it's 170. And so I would like to move that Section 1 be deleted, that Section 2 be renumbered as Section 1, and on page 2, line 31, delete after the comma the words, for a period of 1 year or more. And that's it.
Senator Day.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dill, that is wonderful. That would be just great.
All those in favor of Senator Dill's motion to amend the file, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So adopted. Now the bill should be in order, Senator Day, that you'd like to have it.
Chairman.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, Terry Palmer, Department of Military Affairs, and we thank Senator Day for bringing this bill forward and for bringing it into this format. We are very much in favor of this provision. We like the language because it's permissive to the city, county, municipalities. So it doesn't remove the responsibility from local government to do what it's supposed to do, but it also is permissive in that it's a deferment of the special assessments. It's not a forgiveness. So we think that's a fair and appropriate on both sides of the for the soldiers and for the local governments. Thank you, sir.
Mr. Rock.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jennifer O'Rourke. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. And we were first brought to attention with this bill when it came up on the House side, and Representative Ruth brought it forward because the city of Owatonna actually wanted to help out some of the military folks in their area and realized, I believe, that they didn't think they were able to under current law. So I believe what they came forward with was a basic amendment to the senior property tax deferral program, and that's what you see in front of you. The League itself really doesn't have an official position on this bill, but we think that it's great that this would be an option for cities. It certainly keeps the local control part of it intact. Cities would have to develop, if you will, sort of a program at the local level to set up a procedure for folks to go through. This would only be a one-year deferral, so the property taxes still would get paid. And we think this is an ideal part of the law to amend if they're going to go forward with this proposal.
Another day we have another technical amendment that the council will help us with.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Day, just a suggestion on the head note. since you've changed the substance of that section, on page 2, line 22, I think it would make sense just to delete for seniors or, and then on line 23, disabled, and that way it'll just the section will be named hardship assessment deferral.
Mr. Chairman, that would be fine. Thank you for bringing that up.
I would, Mr. Chairman, I'd move that as an oral amendment if that's what you want.
Referring moves the oral amendment. Everybody understand amendment? No, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? So adopted. Now, Senator Day, I think the bill's in pretty good shape. I need somebody, Senator Workman, to move that Senate file number 170 as amended be recommended passed and is asked to go to state and local government.
So moved.
Any questions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So adopted. Thank you, Senator.
Chamber, Mr. Chairman, and members, thank you. And thank you for moving me up a little bit. I can go do some more damage someplace.
Now we're going to still switch around here just a little bit. Senator Skoy, we're going to pick yours up because you have some people that come from a distance.
Great, thank you.
That would be Senate File 1211.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I am pleased to be here with Senate File Number 1211 today. I do have a couple of oral amendments that I would like to make in order to get the bill in the shape that I'd like. The appropriation line on line 9, I'd like to add $300,000 to that line. And Mr. Chair, I would move that. If you want me to do both of them, I can.
Why don't you do both of them? We'll take them all as one motion.
On line 15, after cellulosic, it's the word waste. I'd like to strike that and insert materials.
Well, that's going to score it. Say and material.
Just strike the word waste and put materials in there. In the drafting of this, we thought that we might be using just straw and corn stover, et cetera, but I think we would now like to utilize grasses that would be growing.
Everybody understand the motion? Senator Skoy, I want to thank you for putting the $300,000 in there because I've been around here long enough. You send a blank, people don't really like that. So put your money in there that you think we need, and then we'll go with that.
Mr. Chair, we were working with the university to come up with a number, and I think that this would be a number that would fulfill the needs to get this thing going.
Okay. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So adopted. Now, Senator Skoy, your bill's in order.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And as I said, I'm really pleased to be here with this for a number of reasons. First, we heard a lot of testimony earlier this year about the environmental benefits that can accrue to the state as we move towards cellulosic ethanol, environmental benefits and economic benefits. And one of the things that is going to drive the attraction of bringing these plants to Minnesota is a supply of the cellulosic material. If we're successful in this project, we think that we will be developing up to 3,500 acres of test plots and production acres with cellulosic supply. That would be a start as we try to bring these plants to Minnesota. The White Earth Reservation is right at the junction of the three major biomes in Minnesota, the deciduous forest, the coniferous forest, and the prairies. So there's a wide array of different materials that can be used in this research project, and I think it's an ideally suited location to run this experimental project, Mr. Chair and members. And I'm here with the chairwoman of the White Earth Band, Irma Visner, and she would like to speak to you. And I also have with me Ken Valentis, who is working with the University of Minnesota and wrote the request for proposals for the university. And if the committee would have the time to hear from Chairwoman Visner, I'd appreciate it, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee, and state your name for the record.
Thank you, Chairman Vickerman and members of the committee. My name is Irma Visner. I'm the tribal chairwoman of the White Earth Nation in northern Minnesota, approximately 250 miles north of here. Our reservation is a large reservation. We are the largest tribe in Minnesota with approximately 20,000 enrolled members, and with those eligible for enrollment, 25,000 whom we serve. Our reservation is economically depressed. We have gaming, but it provides jobs and does a very good job at that. I mean, does it very well at the jobs. However, we need economic development there, and as well as the surrounding area, the three counties and beyond that. And we believe that the ethanol plant will provide the economic stimulus for the not only for the tribe but for the area. We're looking at a large plant. Of course, the research. It's the research and development. We are in partnership with University of Minnesota and very pleased about the partnership. We believe the tribe and University of Minnesota is our good partners. And we will, we also are, along with our partnership with the University of Minnesota to do the research and development and the tribe to work with the economic part of it to put into place the plant itself, as a result of the research and development. We have a tribal college that we would partner also with the University of Minnesota and to provide a training for the jobs. And as you know, we as Native Americans, we're the first stewards and environmentalists of the land, and this is very important to us as a tribe that we have an economically, an environmentally friendly means of energy. And so I think we have 3,500 acres to work with the University of Minnesota on the research end. That's available. However, we're going to need more land, probably 200,000 acres of land to provide the grasses and for the plant. And so I would ask your support for the tribe. Some of you remember me. I work on the gaming issue. I work very hard for the economic development of the tribe, and I feel very excited about ethanol. It's out of necessity. It's going to happen. Thank you.
Ms. Visner, I want to compliment you on trying something different than gambling. I don't like gambling.
Chairman, I would sell ice cream if it would work.
Well, gambling is going to go down. That gambling is already dropping in most places. So I'm glad you're trying something.
Yes, I'm very proud to and pleased to be on the cutting edge of what this country needs.
Senator Scoy, you have another
question? Yes, Mr. Chair. If you had a few minutes for Mr. Valentis to say a few words. He's been working with the University of Minnesota about the project, and give the committee some more detailed information about what the research will be doing.
My name is Ken Valentis. I'm the director of the Biotechnology Institute at the university. What we've proposed is a partnership with the White Earth Reservation to do a feasibility study so that we really can determine whether or not this makes economic sense for the reservation. And we've assembled a team of researchers from the university and other institutions like Princeton, National Research Energy Labs. We've worked with ORI to make sure that we don't leave any stones unturned. So it's a very comprehensive study that we're proposing.
Well, Senator Scroy, you know as well as I do, as they move into this field, there's all kinds of demonstrations, and I think that's what we need to do rather than have one monstrous plant, because there's work to be done here, and it's...
Well, Mr. Chair, you're absolutely right, and as I said, this the location of this land is just ideally suited because of the different biomes that are available to do research on. The White Earth Nation has agreed to let 3,500 of their acres be utilized for this research. We think it's a really good step in developing not only the knowledge but also the base of production for cellulosic material. And I'm excited about this opportunity that's presenting itself.
Senator Engelbretson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one question. The $300,000 for the project, how long is the project going to take, Senator?
Mr. Chair and Senator Engelbretson, perhaps I could let the university talk about that. About what they envision for a time frame.
I think the time frame will be approximately 6 months from the time we actually are able to spend money. It's a multiple investigator. It's not a single investigator. So it's an effort from many, many parts of the university, which can be done parallel, I'm sorry. So it's not a long, drawn-out – it's a feasibility study.
Yeah.
So we hope at the end to be able to say, yes, you can do it, and these are the parameters, and these are the next steps that have to be accomplished from a research standpoint, because prairie grass isn't going to happen overnight. It's going to take some time for that to be developed.
Just one quick follow-up, Mr. Chair. You said that the land is owned by the tribe. Is that right?
Mr. Chair and Senator Engelbretson, yes, that's correct.
Okay.
Any other questions? Senator Dale.
Well, Mr. Chair, members, I think it's a good idea, and we should go ahead and pass this.
Senator Scoy, what's your wishes?
Mr. Chair, I would move that Senate File Number 1211 be recommended to pass and laid on the table for possible inclusion in the Ag Omnibus Finance Bill.
As amended, Senator.
Amended.
Any further discussion? Not all in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? So adopted.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members.
McWitch.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate File 1038, what this bill does is funds the Minnesota Department of Agriculture's Energy and Sustainable Ag Grant Program at $250,000 a year for 2 years. I think this is an excellent program, one that Minnesota should be proud of. Creates farmer-driven innovation and facilities, farmer-to-farmer education. This program provides grants for farmers to conduct on-farm demonstration projects and research into sustainable farming methods. Farmers are constantly thinking about ways to farm better, both more profitable and ways that protect the environment. This program gives them money to try their ideas on their farm. The results are then published annually in the Green Book. This is widely read by other farmers wanting to learn more about sustainable farming practices. And farmers learn best from other farmers, and that is what this program does, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I have two people here. I'm going to start at the gentleman on my right first, and then I'll go back to my gentleman on the left. So,
Thank you, Peterson. Senator Vickerman. Mr. Peterson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And again, my name is Tom Peterson. I represent the Minnesota Farmers Union. I'm going to speak very quickly, give you the Reader's Digest version of our support for Senate File 135, or whatever it is, 1038. I got too many bills going today. Anyways, all right. That would appropriate $250,000 to the Sustainable Ag Demonstration Grants. As Senator Vickerman has said, and as you've heard today, these programs have been very helpful. The Green Book, you can see and kind of look through, and I'm not going to go into great detail on a lot of the great good things, but consider that this program has been around in the state for 17 years now, that it's been helpful, and that I think it's had a good impact in helping our farmers really move forward in a lot of this really growing trend in like grass-fed beef and third crops and alternative crops and organic agriculture. And also a lot of farmers are looking to reduce their inputs and try to use more natural methods, and that helps a lot. I'd also say that the other thing that's important to these books lasts a long time. Representative Ken Shumper in the just paging through and reminded me that Representative Ken Shumper was one of the first grantees in 1992, if you look in your book there. So, and he says he still gets calls from people, and it was amazing the information that goes through. The other important part of these are the field days that go along with them. I've been to several of the field days myself where the farmers can go once the project is kind of done or in process. They have a field day, and that's very positive. And so I just urge you to support this. It's been very effective. And the last thing I just ask you to look at is, if you'd like to, is page 6 has the funding history for this program. And you can see we have funded it as high as $280,000 in the beginning and as high as $200,000 in 2002. And so we've cut it back substantially over the years. And at the same time, I feel the need for these types of farming methods is growing. Thank you. And I did mention that we are lucky to have Mr. Fernholz today with us, who is one of the grantees multiple times. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Mr. Fernholz.
Madam Chair and Committee, I appreciate the opportunity to speak, and I'll be very brief as well. I think it was in the second year of this program that I was awarded a three-year project, and at that time we were looking at the value of livestock.
Excuse me, Mr. Fernholz, I'm sorry. Would you state your name for the record?
Excuse me. Yes, Carmen Fernholz, organic farmer from Madison, Minnesota.
Thank you.
You bet. But as I was saying, I was one of the people awarded one of these grants. I think it was the second year of the operation. And it was a research project to determine the values of livestock manure versus NPK fertilizers versus green manures. And I think it was very early on that we did discover, at least at that time, and we're talking in the early 90s, that yes, indeed, livestock manures are valuable. And I think it has contributed quite a bit into the future of how we can better utilize the animal manures on our operations. A second grant that I was given was dealing with cover crops, and we have found that today one of the hot items is the looking towards the perennialization of the landscape, and looking at it in a sense that we can in fact deal with some of the issues of erosion that are obviously prevalent in conventional, but we also admit they are prevalent in some of the organic practices and some of the organic systems. And so here again, early on, we were looking at ways to alleviate this issue. And finally, a third one that I have applied for, I haven't heard the results of it yet, but is a research project that over 3 years is going to look at alternative sources of phosphorus in an organic system where livestock is not readily available. And we think we can show that there are, in fact, some good sources of phosphorus that can contribute to good organic productions. That's quick in a nutshell.
Thank you, Mr. Fernholz. Senator?
Any further discussion? I guess I'm not the chair. Oh. You got to ask.
Senator, if you have anything additional to say in your bill, otherwise members will take questions.
Okay, Senator. Madam Chair, it'll get better as the weeks go by.
Thank you. Senator, would you like to move your bill?
Madam Chair, I would, no further discussion, I would move that Senate File 1038 be recommended to pass and for possible inclusion in the omnibus budget bill.
Thank you. Is there any further discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion passes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senator Lurie, we want to move along.
Thank you, Errol.
I think you need to keep chewing it because I
wonder if we're going to have a chair. I'm hoping that Chairman Vickerman is not in shock over getting budget figures or something like that that we're not aware of yet. Is that a target? All right.
Senator Lurie, I'll probably preside over your bill and we can have some fun.
Senator Lurie.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm glad to be here. I'm glad that several testifiers for hour plus here today have kind of prepped the committee for yet another organic bill before us today. This Senate File 1039 is for an organic certification cost share. One of the things that I think has come clear today is how much work has to go into organics and how much development it takes in terms of research and in terms of uncertainty about exactly how to approach it. Every farm is different, and it's something that I know of several farmers who are very interested in moving into the organics or sustainable agriculture. I personally am a lifetime member of Farmers Union. I'm a member of Northeastern Minnesota Sustainable Farming Association, and raise some of the food that we eat, and it's something that has always concerned me a great deal. What this bill does is it offers up to 3/4 of the costs of certification, or $500, whichever is greater. We're talking here just the costs of the private companies that come onto the farm and actually certify that you have met all of the requirements for organics, which are great. And I'd like to mention that this is only that portion of the cost that is associated with the private company coming in and certifying them. The private company that comes in and certifies and sends you a bill for that. There's also all the lead up, all of the years that it takes to get your farm ready to go into organics, and it's a very uncertain world. And so I think that it is very worthwhile of state funding and trying to encourage those that are currently practicing organics to stay in the market and stay in that field, and also encourage those who are considering organics, make it a little bit easier for them to enter this world. So again, I'm very proud to have this bill before you here today. Tom Peterson is not only the guy from Farmers Union we hear from all the time, he's a good friend and a constituent. And so I'll let him explain a little bit further this bill. 1039, Tom.
Yeah, okay. I got that. Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Tom Peterson. I'm here to speak in favor of House File 1039, which would increase the state organic cost share
the
certification.
Senate file.
I voted against the House file.
All right. Senate File 1039 that would increase the cost share to $160,000 per year for persons who grow, sell, process, or package organic products. And we're proud to urge your support for the increase in this program that we believe has been a very proactive approach that the state of Minnesota has taken to make us a leader, as you heard Ms. Moynihan say, in organic agriculture. And I did some checking. You know, I called several of our farmers 2 weeks ago when we were going to have the hearing on this bill, and I just to make sure that this is good program. I called a farmer in Senator Gimsey's district, our county chair in Candiohi County. He's a crop farmer, and he says very helpful. His certification is very expensive, and he also has to get a certification to sell organically in Japan. And so, and called a dairy farmer in Senator Scogin's district, who recently just transitioned to dairy. Several dairy farmers in your area are transitioning. And the most interesting call was near our district was a hog farmer and a crop farmer, but he's bringing his grandson into the business. And he said, I could afford the cost share. I didn't even apply for it, but I'm splitting my farm and my grandson he's raising about 100 hogs, and it really helped him, and he's certified. The interesting thing on this guy, though, he's also raising organic hay for a very large organic dairy that's going in our area. And I asked him how that was going with the hay, and he said, good, but the market's not quite there for the hay yet. But he said, you know who's buying the organic hay is all these horse people from the metro area who want to feed their horses organic hay. But that's very interesting when you look at just the trends in the market. So I wanted to also make sure that there is, Ms. Moynihan also mentioned the average cost is $900 about a year that we talk to our producers, but that they have the burden of proof to being organic. And coming on this bill provides some regulatory relief to them. And again, it can run a few hundred dollars and into the thousands. If you're a livestock farmer, you're raising crops and livestock. You have to certify both, so it becomes even more expensive. And there's different areas you can certify, crop, livestock, processing. I'm sorry Senator Hand's not here because I saw him looking through the book, and he does have a Country Choice Organic cookies in his district, I believe, and so it's too bad we missed him there. And then something called Wild Harvest, which would be like maple syrup certifying. So that's important, but it's a big business and a growing business in Minnesota. And there is a federal program, keep in mind, as Ms. Moynihan said, but it's underfunded and inconsistent. And if you look at this bill, it also provides that the commissioner could use that money if the federal government writes the 2007 Farm Bill and kicks in a whole bunch of money for the organic cost share. That money would be available for a lot of the other good things we need. Finally, I want to mention I do chair the State Organic Advisory Task Force, which is appointed by Commissioner Hugesson, and we advise him on ag issues. And this was one of our legislative recommendations that we made to the commissioner to increase it from the current $35,000 a year, but it was not included in the governor's budget. So in closing, I thank you for your consideration. I do think it would be a very helpful, proactive issue.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Senator Lurie, anything else before we go to questions?
No, Tom wrapped it up nicely.
Thank you. We have Senator Coring, Senator Waring, and then Senator Dill. Or Morgan, excuse me.
Madam Chair, I do have an oral amendment on page 1, line 6, change $160,000 to $275,000. And the reason why I'm doing that is there's it's my understanding there's over 500 organic farmers and processors at a cost share of $500 each. That would comes to about $250,000 and $25,000 for administration. So it actually, the number actually should be 275, and so I'm hoping that Senator Lurie will accept that as a friendly amendment. And it's come to my understanding that the House file, they do have that changed over there to 275 also.
Thank you, Senator Coring. Actually, yeah, there's the 500 organic farms, and then there's also 125 organic processors that would be eligible for this as well. So it would still be probably not meet all of the need, but I would certainly consider 275 in both years, right, as a friendly amendment, and would encourage your support for that as well.
Okay. We have an amendment from Senator Coring on the table. Is there any further discussion? Senator Dill.
Well, Madam Chair and members and Senator Lurie, is this $500 deal, is that something they have to do every single year?
Yes, it is. Yeah, they have to recertify every single year, and the $900 is an average cost for just paying the private company that comes out and makes sure that, again, the burden of proof is on the farmer, and a private company has to come out and certify that, yes, they've met that burden of proof, and then they send you a bill for that. And this would cover up to three-quarters of that cost or $500, whichever is less.
Well, Madam Chair, members, and Senator Lurie, Mr. Peterson, I understand the economic advantage to the farmer for producing organic food because there is a market out there and you can get more for it. So that's pretty clear, and I really support organic production because there is a market out there. But from the consumer standpoint, maybe Mr. Peterson can answer this, what's the economic advantage to the consumer to buy organic food, which is much more expensive than non-organic food?
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Well, you know, supply and demand is, you know, one thing, too, as we're saying that, you know, the more organics we can get out there, too, that I would think helps with the price. Buying locally is very important to organics. That this bill helps, gives Minnesota an advantage so that our big co-ops and our food processors like Sysco and different people that are handling. Organics has become mainstream since I've been here working at Farmers Union at the legislature. You look at Walmart, Target, all your big chains now have a large organic section. And this bill helps give Minnesota producers an advantage to get into organics. And that's very important. I've looked at this extensively, is that, you know, who's going to fill that void if we're not filling the milk shelves at Lund's, where we toured Lund's and Byerly's this summer, and they were out of milk at $6.29 a gallon, and they said the supply isn't there. The demand's there, but the supply isn't there. So this helps our farmers transition and get into that, and I think it's a good incentive. So hope that kind of answers the question.
Thank you, well, Mr. Peterson. Senator Scoy. Okay, Senator Dill.
Well, Madam Chair, members, I don't know if the question was quite answered. I asked what the economic advantage was. And what I did a few years ago is I took the price of organic food for a whole year versus non-organic food and measured the difference in the price and then calculated that over a 40-year period. No, I think it was a 30-year period. And if that added money that had gone into the grocery purchasing had been stuck in the stock market at an 8 or 10% return on investment, then you kind of get an idea what it really cost over a 40-year, I think it was a 30-year period to go with the organic versus the standard production. And I believe the difference was something like $500,000. It cost, you know, you're talking thousands of dollars a year for a family of four over a full year. And if those thousands were invested elsewhere, the cost of going organic to the consumer was about $500,000. Now, of course, there's some people that believe that it's healthier and you want to support that kind of agriculture and so forth, and that's fine, because I think that's fine, but it's also important to understand what it's costing you to do that.
Thank you for the comment. I wonder what the organic hay for the horses would run in addition.
Thank you, Senator Laurie. Senator Scoy, is it on the same subject, or otherwise we'll go to Senator Worgen?
Well, it's kind of along that line, a little different. I don't care. Well, I can wait.
I wonder if we should – are we going to vote on my amendment, or are we taking questions on my amendment?
I think this is still a conversation on your amendment.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yes, Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and maybe Senator Laurie or Mr. Peterson. With regard to what Senator Dill said, I think individuals will make their own decisions, and what they do. And, you know, more power to the farmers who can take advantage of this. The question that I have is, who sets the $900 certification cost? And the reason I ask this is my neighbors raise organic horseradish. And everybody thinks that's pretty odd, I know, but they do. And so they went through the process to become certified. And I understand the first time you did the certification, it was pretty extensive, and you had to prove that you had your land out of, you know, 5 years and all of that stuff. And I can see the cost getting to the first time around would be quite expensive. But once you've done that, why is it costing $900 to do the second and the third year when you've already gone through all the extensive proof? You're just updating it every year. It seems to me it should be significant less. So who establishes that they get $900 for doing that?
Madam Chair, I'm going to let Tom Peterson answer that in large part, but I think that one of the things we've got to keep in mind is we have the wrong Mr. Peterson here to answer that, and Colin Peterson would be a very good one. It's mostly national, federal regulations regarding organic certification that drives the cost of the annual certification process, and this is just what it is today, but Tom might have a lot more idea about what goes into that. And that this is an average, including those that are first-time certification and those that are subsequent certifications.
Well, Madam Chair, maybe Senator Lurie answered my question. So this is a cost that's driven by national requirements?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Well, that explains why it costs so much, I guess.
Senator Gimsey, is your question related to Senator Coring's amendment?
No, I think it's more, Madam Chair, I think it's more of a general question.
Okay, we'll get back to you in just 1 second. Any other discussion on Senator Coring's amendment?
Do you want me to reiterate my amendment,
please,
Madam Chair?
Sir.
Okay. On page 1, line 6, change $160,000 to $275,000. And what my reasoning is for that is we have over 500 organic farms plus processors at an average cost of about $500, cost share of about $500. So that comes to about $250,000. And then I put in another $25,000 for administration, so it comes to $275,000. So changing the $160,000 to $275,000 on page 1, line 6.
That would renew my amendment. Coring, it needs to be changed in two places.
Oh, really?
I understand. Is there another line?
Same line.
Each place. Oh, same line. Okay.
Same line. Okay.
Well, I said line 6. Oh, okay.
Twice. Times two.
But
Senator Dale.
On that, Madam Chair, Senator Coring, on that point, if there's 500 farmers plus 125 processors, you really need 312,000.
Right. We'll just try to make do with this. There isn't enough money to go around, Senator Dale. So.
Any other discussion on Senator Coring's amendment? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carries. Thank you. Okay, now we're back to Senator Wergen and then Senator Gimsey.
Madam Chair, sometimes you need a light moment and some questions just beg being asked, especially when it's Senator Lurie sitting there. You indicated that this is an organic bill. I wonder if you've had it certified as organic or you're just calling it an organic bill.
I haven't gone through the certification process yet. I'm waiting for the funding to come through.
Senator Gimsey.
Senator Dill's statement kind of intrigued me a little bit. Do you, and I know it probably isn't fair to ask you this question because there were other testifiers that could have probably answered it, but do we know the demographics of the people who are consuming organic products, what as far as their income levels compared, any kind of a comparison there? Are they higher income people? Are they lower income people that tend to consume?
I have read some articles. I'm not prepared to give a detailed answer.
You know, Madam Chair and Senator, I don't know anecdotally, you know, we do hear that higher income people tend to, but the interest runs the gamut on what different products on organic and seeing also in rural parts of the states, the availability at stores. We've also had bills here at the legislature, for example, WIC. Products don't allow you to get organic milk and different things. So that's, you know, an issue, too, that we've tried to address here at the legislature from time to time. But I don't know other than anecdotally.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Senator Lurie, what would you like to do with your amended bill today?
I would like to lay my bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
As amended. Okay. Is there any other discussion on Senator Lurie's bill? All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you.
Why did you?
Yes.
What with the team? Smooth on this side. It was tough on the
hearing rope. Let's hear about your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I believe you have before you an amended delete all amendment, Senate File 409. I have a one amendment that I would move be accepted.
Erickson Robes, you'd like to put this on to get your bill in order? You'd like to have it?
Yes, please.
Okay, so let's. Why don't you make that motion, and we'll explain Did you make the motion yet?
Yes, sir, I made the motion.
I'm still losing it today.
That's okay. You're a long ways away from me, Senator.
Well, one thing about this committee, we can have fun in it.
That's
this
right.
Yeah. Okay. Any discussion? Well, let's put it on, then we'll discuss it. Senator Sherrington Robes moves the adoption of the A1 amendment. Is there any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Now your bill's in order. Now I have to watch this. Coring is just smiling over here. I don't know if you're going to ask me a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Glad to be before you again this afternoon. I'm joined by Brian Bergson from the Attorney General's Office. I would like to remind this committee that the Federal Servicemen Civil Relief Act, called SCRA, provides certain provisions for servicemen and women on active duty in the United States Armed Services, as well as service members that are called to active state duty because of a federal emergency. And despite those protections, the SCRA fails to protect service members in a few important respects. For example, while SCRA protects service members' families from evictions, it fails to protect them from being disconnected from utilities such as gas and electricity. This omission is significant because numerous studies and surveys have indicated that around 4 of 10 National Guards members and reservists who are now on active duty make less money when they're mobilized than they did as civilians. At least 26% of military families have had to resort to high-interest payday loans to make up for a shortfall in that income. So I'm putting before you today a bill that would add additional state protections that are necessary. And another example, I believe Senator Wergen had a bill that passed the floor just recently for military small business owners, providing them some extra protection and permission to cancel contracts on things like copying machines. My bill would allow any service member who has been issued orders into active duty to terminate without penalty their wireless service contract, to terminate without penalty rental contracts, club contracts, and membership contracts, and to obtain payment arrangements for utilities, services, and protections from shutoffs. And I will stand for questions. We'll stand for questions.
Senator Wergen.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Senator Erickson Ropes, has this happened to various people? I mean, is that where this is coming from?
I'll let Senator Bergson.
Boy.
Mr. Bergson, address that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Brian Bergson from Attorney General Lori Swanson's office. Mr. Chair and Senator Wergen, yes. We have gotten complaints from soldiers on the battlefield that are having to pay their cell phone bill or their internet service or their satellite TV service. And so that prompted this legislation.
Thank you.
Any other discussions? Senator Chaudhry?
A lot of these contracts, if the law requires them to be older, servicemen is not obligated. These companies can absorb the cost. Not always the case in terms of with regards to residential leases. You've got, depending on it, the type of property, it could very easily be the difference. That rent, relying on that rent, can be the difference between making the mortgage payment on that property or not. What are you looking at specifically doing in the case of a rental residential lease or residential rental contract?
Mr. Chairman,
will the landlord be out of luck?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Chaudhry, the landlord would have to break the lease with the service member. When I was activated and I volunteered for Desert Storm, I was living in an apartment building down on the river in Minneapolis, and I got my orders on a Friday, and I was to report to Fort Hood on Monday, and I was on my way to drill, actually, up in Hibbing,
and I turned around and went to my parents' house in Cloquet, picked up my orders, and came back home late Friday night. And the next morning, Saturday, I went in to the rental office for the apartment building and said, here is a copy of my orders. I understand that I'm allowed to break my lease because I'm certainly not going to be able to live here. And they said, no, you're not. You're going to have to pay your rent. I immediately panicked. I was a young man. I didn't realize a lot of the rules and regulations. I thought, boy, I'm going to have to pay rent while I'm gone. I called my unit. My unit told me to call the U.S. Attorney's office, and I called then U.S. Attorney Tom Heffelfinger at home. Within a half an hour, the maintenance man for the apartment building, who was a Vietnam veteran from the 1st Cav, and that was the unit I was going to, the 1st Cav, was helping me pack my bags and move out of my apartment, and my lease was broken. So, yes, unfortunately, the property owner or the person that is renting the property would have to sever the lease.
Senator Erickson-Robes.
Mr. Chair, Senator Chaudhry, I am a property owner myself, and in some discussion with other property owners, it seems that the general consensus is if this happens, you don't want to continue to charge the servicemen, and the most we'd probably be out would be 1 month's rent, because when the person moves out, you put it back on the market and then hopefully re-rent. And Mr. Bergson says that's already in the federal bill as well.
In the federal law.
Senator Wergen.
Mr. Chair, just a question. If a serviceman leaves and calls to break the lease, what happens to the property and the apartment? How is that dealt with? Or don't you foresee that?
Mr. Chair and Senator Wergen, currently the Federal Civil Relief Act allows soldiers and sailors to break their lease. Where I guess our bill is not asking for rental leases on apartments to be broken. I guess that's already the federal statute. But your question was?
Well, Mr. Chair, it was more a curiosity than anything, because I agree with the bill and understand what you're doing. But in the event that a serviceman, you said you had a fairly fast turnaround
yes.
time. Would there be the event that a serviceman couldn't get their property out? How would that be handled?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Wergen, one of the problems we had back then was this act hadn't been used since,
right.
you know, Vietnam or World War II extensively. And so a lot of people were not educated on it. I think now a lot more people are having to, unfortunately, have had to have this experience. I guess what would probably happen is a soldier or sailor would have to move their stuff or their belongings out to their parents' house or a friend's house or a rental place, and then the apartment would be left vacant if they had the time. Otherwise, it would fall, I suppose, the burden would fall on their family, which would be unfortunate.
Well, members, I think we may be straying just a little bit into another committee's jurisdiction. I think what we should be hinging in on, this is a good idea. We'll send it to Commerce, and they can do the penalties and all of that. Senator Wergens?
Mr. Chair, you're right. I just do have one other question, though.
Sure.
If this is already federal law, why do we have to do it?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Wergen, federal law doesn't cover everything. For example, federal law will not allow someone to break their wireless contract. They will not allow them to break...
Mr. Chair, I was referring just to the lease.
Oh.
The property lease.
Mr. Chair, Senator Wergen, I think it was just added in order to cover everything, since we're already talking about health club contracts and that sort of thing.
Senator Sheridan Ropes, what do you wish to do with your bill?
Mr. Chair, I recommend this bill to pass and be referred to the Commerce Committee, as amended.
Moves that Senate File 409 be recommended to pass as amended and be referred to the Commerce Committee to give it further direction. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? So adopted. Now, members, we have one final thing. We need to finish up the Department of Agriculture. If they would come up, and we had it earlier, and we want to talk about discussion of the governor's budget recommendations and policy language. We need to, if you look in your folder, it's 1001, which should be starting on page 36. Everybody find it? Okay, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record, and let's. I'm watching that clock, and we've got to be out of here by 5:30.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Steve Ernest, Financial Management Director with the Department of Agriculture. We've already walked through the budget document, but as I go through the bill, I'll just reference the page numbers for the change items. In Senate File 1001, Article 1, Section 11 is the Department of Agriculture's budget. Subdivision 2, the Protection Services. The first rider there is our base rider for administration for the remediation fund. That's the fund that's managed by the Department of, or the Pollution Control Agency. Second two rider, the second and third rider there are in our change item for the Clean Water Legacy.
Can I interrupt you just for a minute? We should be on page 29. Is that?
That's right.
Just so we're tracking you. Go ahead. Excuse
That's
me.
That's right. Page 29. Rider on 29.5 for 800,000 each year, and the rider on 29.9 for 200,000 each year are parts of our Clean Water Legacy change item that's found on page 44 of the budget document. Rider on 29.15 is the invasive species. Part of the, actually, both the clean water and this invasive species are split in two parts of the bill for the different divisions that work on them. This portion of the invasive species rider is for our pest management. This is for invasive species that are not yet in the state, is what I want to say. The other part of this initiative is to manage invasives that have already got here, but we want to minimize their damage, and I'll point that out when we get to it. Line 29.18 is 90,000 and 92,000 for the meat inspection additional money. That change item is found on page 28 of the budget bill, a budget document. The rider on 29.21 is for our electronic field inspection system. This is to for the Food and Dairy Inspection Division to extend what we're already doing in the pesticide and fertilizer, what we're just getting into with electronic field inspection, extend that to the dairy and food activities. Change item is found on page 25 of the budget book. The rider on 29.27 is for our emergency planning and response change item, which is found on page 27 of the budget book. Marketing and development on 30.1. This is our Minnesota Grown rider, and this we have $71,000 a year in the base, and then we have a change item on page 40 of the budget document for another $65,000 a year. This gets transferred into our Minnesota Grown account in the agricultural fund for those activities that program covers. On line 30.11, we have some language to combine the two accounts we now have in the agricultural fund into one account, just to make the accounting for the money simpler. You get annual reports on the agricultural fund, and this will show you all the activity in one place. The rider on page 30.17 is a base rider for sustainable agricultural demonstration grants. And the rider on 30.30 is also a base rider for livestock siting assistance. On 30.14, this is the other part of our invasive species change item. This is in the development division, which is for species that are already existing in the state. And on 31.17, this is the other part of the Clean Water Legacy change item, which is for the Ag Best Management Practices loans. On 31.23, the value-added products, this basically is our ethanol producer payment program. There are currently 10 plants in the program. A couple more will go off next year, and so we'll have 8 in the program in 09, just 2 in the program in 010. That's the last year of the regular payments. And then we would anticipate if this rider stays at $15.168 million, that we would pay off our deficiency payments for plants who were in the program since 2003 but weren't being paid their whole amount in fiscal year 2013. We just need a little money in fiscal 2013 to finish off the deficiency payments.
So, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Dale.
On the point you're on right now, Mr. Ernest, on the $15 million a year, is there going to be any of that, any surplus money left in the next year or two? I think Senator Sams had put a provision in law that would continue on and be used for rural economic development purposes. When is the first date some of that money is available?
2013. Mr. Chairman and Senator, the first date that we anticipate money being available for anything other than ethanol is 2013.
Okay, thank you.
Rider on line 30.8 for $100,000 per year for combustion efficiency grants is a base item. And then on 32.12, $5 million per year is our next gen energy item. There's also a section in section 18 of the bill is for the other half, the out years portion of this change item. But this rider here describes how the $5 million per year would be given out in grants. This is designed to be decided on by a panel consisting of six people with expertise. You see the names listed there on 32.29 through 33.2, and those are the names of the people who would appoint the people on the panel, but it says that they would be six people with expertise appointed by those people. So it wouldn't be actually those people on the panel. The grant would be up to 20% of the project cost and maximum of $500,000. That change item is found on page 49 of the budget book. On line 33.21 is our base rider for the dairy development program, $1.005 million per year. The next two riders are also base items in our budget, $50,000 a year for the Northern Crops Institute and $19,000 per year for the Livestock Breeders Association. And then there's a little language there that says how we pay our county fair grants. That's also base language, just to say that we pay them in the year following when they hold the fair. On line 34.22 is also a base item in our budget for the Northern Minnesota Forage Turf Seed Advisory Committee, $65,000 per year. And then $200,000 per year on line 34.31 for the Second Harvest Heartland grants. And this also is a base item. It started out $100,000 per year 2 years ago, and then another $100,000 was added last year. And line 35.26 is a base item also in our budget, $100,000 per year for farm family assistance, counseling and assistance there. And the last one, $18,000 per year, is also a base item to the Horticultural Society. Article 2 of the bill, sections 2 through 27 are our language items. Most of them implement the change items. On 36.29 gives us some new language to sub-grant federal funds. Sometimes the federal award is designed to be passed through from one agency to another, and this language was modeled after language that exists in the Pollution Control Agency's statutes. So other agencies are doing this, and we just try to follow. Obviously, we can't use federal money for anything they don't want us to use it for, but this gives us the authority then to pass it on without going through a formalized competitive bid process that we normally would require. Section 3 is for our marketing grants, and we're just updating how much we're allowed to give out per recipient on line 37.21. Section 4 starts a few sections that change the Minnesota Grown program. We just broadened the use on line 38.7 for who can use the label. On line 38.16, that's our change item to request the fee be increased. That change item, again, is on page 40 of the budget book. Section 6 clarifies the use of the money that is in the account, kind of broadening it because we are combining the two accounts into one. We had the matching side and the labeling side. Section 7 just states what all can go in that account. So it's our general fund that we get, the revenues from the licensing, gifts, and penalties. all go into that one account, so you'll get a better idea of what the full size of the whole account is once we combine the whole program is once we combine the two accounts. And then Section 8 there rewrites language that is in the deleted account statute just to say what that there is a match requirement. We say that it's at least $1 private for each $4 of state money, but we do get more than that. And I'll just mention that in the repealers, which is Section 57 of the bill, Minnesota Statute 17.109, it also is in there, which repeals the existing matching account. Sections 9 and 10 move two accounts out of the agricultural fund. These are the BMP revolving loan accounts and revolving loan account and the ISTS septic loan accounts, and then the fees that we can charge to go with. And we haven't actually started charging these application fees yet. But these are our loan accounts, and the agricultural fund is for fee-supported activities, and we don't believe they belong in the agricultural fund, so this just moves them to the special revenue fund, and they do have their own annual report on the programs, the loan program, so that you wouldn't be missing out on any reports on that money. Another thing we repeal in our change item on page 16 of the budget book is the aquatic pest control license. The repealers, Minnesota Statutes 18B.315 is repealed. Sections 11, 12, 13, and 15 here in the bill are just to remove cross-references to that repealed license.
Pardon me a minute. Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry, I didn't catch your name. What's going to happen with the aquatic pest license then, or what's going to happen with the license over water?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scoy, this license requirement, the people who would apply pesticides on water would still be required to get a pesticide applicator license, which is an existing broader license. We do have testing requirements and such for that. This was a special class which created a tiered licensing system, and it was burdensome, and we weren't licensing enough people, so we want to remove some of those burdens and have them go under the basic pesticide license and hopefully get enough out there who are licensed so that we don't keep getting complaints.
So, Mr. Chair, you're just doing away with the aquatic pest control license?
Mr. Chair, Senator, that's right.
And therefore the exemptions aren't necessary?
That's right.
Thank you.
Section 14 of the bill is a provision you saw recently in the Fertilizer Council bill that was before you that just clarifies for bulk fertilizer storage under 6,000 gallons. They don't need the separate permitting requirement. I think that was discussed when that bill was before you. Section 16 of the bill is for our change item. That's on page 30 of the budget book. And that increases the food handler plan review fees. That causes an increase of our revenues of about $13,000 per year. Section 17 would be to reestablish a task force on food safety and defense. This goes with our initiative on food safety, but this also is an item that I believe could possibly go on its own because it sets up a task force. Section 18 is the item I referred to earlier when there was the appropriation for the 0809 money for the next gen proposal, which again is on page 49 of the budget book. This is to set up our goals for helping the industry in years 2010 through 2020. We would set a goal for $9 million a year, $6 million for investment incentives, and $3 million for direct payments. This sets up a board to recommend how those monies would be used, and this is composed of actual commissioners and legislators.
Mr. Chair, could I just get a clarification on, are we hearing this bill right now, or are we getting a budget review? I mean, I don't know. It seems like I'm just curious, trying to figure out what we're trying to do here.
Senator Laurie, this is a continuation of last a couple weeks ago on a Thursday. I wasn't able to be here, so I missed the first part.
Oh, okay.
But it's just a continuation of the ag report, and then with it's not a bill. It's just a continuation of. Okay. I think I'm right.
I mean, we're stepping through a bill. This is a bill, right?
Mr. Chairman, earlier we had done part of the budget review using the budget books, but it didn't contain some of the policy language, I believe, that went with the change items in the budget. This bill was introduced recently so we could pick up some of the policy language associated with the change items. Although we're not going to be acting on this particular document, we just felt that it was easier to follow.
Report. Okay. That's what it is.
Oh, thank you.
Continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And again, I am only presenting the parts of the bill that are for our agency, not Department of Natural Resources or Pollution Control Agency or other agency that aren't under this committee. Sections 19 through 27 then is our last group of sections in this bill, and these all apply to the Rural Finance Authority programs. We have mostly technical changes. Section 19 deals with the overall eligibility for our RFA loan programs, and it just clarifies some redundant wording and that refers to the corporate farm law. Minnesota Statutes 500.24 clarifies what the definition of who is eligible for our programs is. In the repealers, 41B.043, subdivision 1A is also repealed, and that deals with the next three sections, sections 20, 21, and 22. That's under the Ag Improvement.
Pardon me, Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Ernst. Back on the next gen energy, and then back to page 32, line 24. In the next gen energy part, you have a board to research and report, and then back on page 32, line 24, there's a panel. Could you explain what's going on with those two groups of? I guess it's the commissioners. Well, they're different. Is that necessary, or what's going on with those two groups of people?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scoy, well, the way this is designed, the first money we have is for gasification grants, and we're kind of in a more developmental phase on that right now. The way we set up the advisory panel, we wanted people with expertise to sort of help us through these next couple years. At this point, you know, this board in the second one, in the statute here, 41A.10, that's a couple years out, but we kind of we thought that a higher level or a more policy-oriented approach was more appropriate for that money. It is, they are specifically designed differently, kind of with the different nature of the programs in mind, because the $9 million a year in our change item is designed to be used differently.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Chair and Mr. Ernst, well, the way I'm looking at it, the Commissioner of Ag and the Commissioner of Commerce, Commissioner of Employment and Economic Development, Commissioner of Pollution Control are all the same. The only difference that I can see is on the first one, you've got the majority leader of the Senate and the Speaker of the House, and on the second one, you've got two members of the Senate and two members of the House. Maybe we could kind of roll that together, and I mean, it looks like it's pretty similar.
Mr. Chairman, on line... on line 32.24, we say a panel consisting of six people with expertise related to the subject. Okay, and then we say each of the following individuals shall appoint a member. And then on line 44.14 or 44.13, we say the board consisting of commissioners of. So our assumption here is this is the actual commissioners and the actual legislators. And With the first one, they appoint people.
Mr. Chair, but on line 44.17, you say that the member can designate another to represent them. So, I mean, I don't, it's kind of like we're doing the same thing, but that's just not a big deal, something you maybe you want to think about.
Senator Chaudhry.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. On the page 31, the value-added agricultural products, is this a continuation of producer payments that have been in the base? It was my understanding that producer payments were scheduled to end at some point. Could you let me inform me on what the situation is with that?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator Chaudhry, Minnesota Statutes 418.09 says that the regular payment program does end in 2010. That's the last year we can give regular producer payments. That last year we'll only have two plants that are still going on 10 years in the program. They can only be in the program for 10 years, and 2010 is the last year anyone can be in the regular payment program. Our number here, 15.168 million, is our direct appropriated number, and we give that out first for regular payments. But then, because starting in 2003, we didn't pay the full 20 cents per gallon because of budget constraints, and we had riders that said we should pay only 13 cents instead of 20 cents. We've calculated all those for all those plants that were in during those years, and we have these deficiency payments that the same statute says we have to make and continue making until we pay them all off. And so if we keep getting 15.168, our calculations are we'll have all those deficiencies paid off very early in 2013. We'd only need, I think, $765,000 in 2013, and then that would end that program, and other value-added programs then could use the remainder of that $15 million that year.
And just to follow up on that, it's kind of a newbie to the ethanol industry. It's my understanding that the industry is undergoing a lot of private investment. There's in fact quite a boom in the industry. Does the administration feel that the producer payments are still necessary?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Chaudhry, yes, we have this program in our base to carry out the commitments that we've made over the years. I think these programs are counting on this assistance, and the industry is important to us.
We need to move along because it's already 5:30, and I know other people have other things they'd like to do. So let's just continue on, and we can come back maybe another day and look at some of this. So if you would keep going.
All right, Mr. Chairman. Sections 20 through 23 remove the direct loan method of making loans for the Ag Improvement Loan Program. This is what I was saying. We're repealing the direct loan portion. We really like to partner with local lenders on these, so we're just cleaning this up to match with the practice we make. Section 23 is a repeat of the focusing our definition of who's eligible for our programs. It refers to Section 41B.03, Subdivision 1, which is the one that we are amending in Section 19 of the bill, so that makes that consistent. Section 24 is our Disaster Recovery Loan Program, and we are just opening this up a little bit as to who possibly could qualify for this, and especially you'll see on line 46.14, when we had the drought, we had some questions on whether some of those things would be eligible for this program. We are also on line 46.24 making consistent the net worth value for who can borrow money out of this program. This is consistent with other programs that the Rural Finance Administration Authority handles. And we are also moving or combining this disaster recovery loan program in with our group of revolving loan programs, which are together in one account for fiscal purposes. The Rural Finance Authority Board votes on what the current priorities for the use of the money are, and then they vote on who gets to borrow it when they make applications. But this, we wanted to have this more readily available if disasters like the drought occur, so that the board could move some money between programs. The programs that are in this group are livestock equipment, methane digester, value-added ag, and value-added ag products, so this would add disaster to that list of options for the use of this money. Section 25 amends the livestock equipment loan program. There was some confusion on what is the first purchase of equipment, so we've just taken the word first out of there. And we removed the restriction on preference for some loans, which was just preference and not a little confusing. Also, we increased the availability for equipment loans to 10 years from 7 years on line 48.8 because some of this equipment is very expensive and takes a while to pay off. And we've added hoop barns, portable structures, hay and forage equipment, and related structural work on lines 48.30 to 33 because we've had requests from local lenders to have these be eligible in the program. Section 26 on line 49.7 shows where we're adding this disaster recovery loan program to the list that you see there that I already mentioned for this account, which the board can move money between. And then Section 27 reduces the requirement for participation in farm management programs from 5 years to 3 years. The farmer has to pay about $11,000 a year to be in this program, and we also wanted to make that consistent with what we require for the basic and seller-assisted loan programs, just 3 years. And that is the last section of our language in Article 2, except for the repealers. I did mention the Minnesota Grown second account is being repealed, the aquatic pest control license is being repealed, and the RFA direct loan method is being repealed. And then we have one other, which is a fertilizer fee provision, 18C.425, and that was a duplicative enforcement provision in the law.
I believe, does that finish up?
And that finishes it, yeah.
It's 25 to 5 members. On Thursday, pay attention, on Thursday, we're going to begin to construct a committee budget bill. We'll be working off from the governor's budget recommendations and also the bills that we've heard up to date. So we start the process, we have to get the process going. So we'll start right on time on Thursday, and hopefully we can get done before 5:30. Well, if there's no other discussion, thanks, members, for sticking around a little bit late, but this meeting is adjourned.